It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin, in for Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the grand jury decision in the Ferguson, Missouri case and its impact in the Pittsburgh area. If you have a question or a comment, please give us a call at 412-246-2002 or tweet us at ESSPGH. Thousands of people demonstrated mostly peacefully in cities across the country, including Pittsburgh. President Obama appealed for calm, pleading with protesters and police to show restraint. The president called for a larger conversation regarding police and community interaction.
We need to recognize that the situation in Ferguson speaks to broader challenges that we still face as a nation. The fact is, in too many parts of this country, a deep distrust exists between law enforcement and communities of color. Some of this is the result of the legacy of racial discrimination in this country. And this is tragic because nobody needs good policing more than poor communities with higher crime rates. The good news is we know there are things we can do to help. And I've instructed Attorney General Holder to work with cities across the country to help build better relations between communities and law enforcement.
President Obama calling for calm last night. So demonstrations in other cities across the country were reported as peaceful, if not in Ferguson. Joining us now to talk about the mood in the Pittsburgh area are Tim Stevens. Tim is the chair of the Black Political Empowerment Project. And Julia Johnson, lead organizer and local social justice activist for today's rally. And continuing with us in Studio A as well is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. Tim and Julia, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Each of you, I'd like you to give us your reactions to the decision announced last night in Ferguson and what you've assessed so far about the mood in the Pittsburgh area from residents with whom you've been talking. Let's start with Julia.
Thank you. The people of Pittsburgh right now, the mood, I can tell you, is one of anger, frustration, and sadness. This decision has weighed heavy on the hearts and minds of all of us in the community who are concerned about police brutality and systemic racism.
Tim, let's get your reaction to get some specific questions about moving forward in the Pittsburgh area and police community relations in general.
The moving forward piece.
Yeah, let's get to your reaction to last night.
Julia's been out in the street yesterday at 5 with the protesters and midnight. I'll be down to help make sure there aren't any issues between the police and the community today at 2. But I'm feeling drained, and I know she has to be with, first of all, leadership in that kind of role is a lot of weight, a lot of pressure. And what I noticed myself was I stayed up most of the night watching the news, is a profound sense of sadness. I have been an activist literally since the 60s, and I was a young adult when we saw fires across the country in the 60s, before Martin Luther King was assassinated, when there were issues in various cities. And it reminded me somewhat of those days. And the sadness is that the inequalities in the nation have never gone away. The fires that we saw, the looting, which certainly I don't support, most of us don't support in the community, is a symbol. It's a symbol of frustration. Mm-hmm. Symbol of anger. It's a symbol of literally decades of inequality. That may sound like an old expression, but it's an old expression that still remains in reality.
Okay, I want to get to that sort of history of attitude, of relationships, of incidents, dare we say, in the Pittsburgh area.
We've had them here for decades.
Yeah.
When I was NACB president, I had a conversation with Bill, the former council member, Bill Robinson,
right?
Former city council member,
former state
current
rep.
County councilman, and former state rep. Just two of us talking many years ago. He said, Tim, The issue that seems like upsets black people more than any is the relationship between the police and the community. And I've been out of office for 10 years, so it has to be over 10 years when we had that conversation.
Okay.
Some things don't change. And as you know, when I came into office as president of the NAACP, it was 1994, November. So my first full term was 95, 96. A good deal of that was dealing with Johnny Gamage.
Johnny Gamage.
31-year-old black businessman killed at the hands of white police. Unarmed, no history of negative behavior.
And not convicted, mistrials.
And nothing. And the story has continued since, with obviously the beating of Jordan Miles. I can't believe how many white people walked up to me about that and said that young man, in the suburbs even, suburban people that I know, said that young man should not have been beaten. What's going on with that? Leon Ford, we just sent a letter to the DA this morning early and put that in the mail to him this afternoon to once again, as we did on September 15th, to ask that he drop the additional charges on Leon Ford.
Right.
And now, Leon Ford, and Julia, I'm sure we want to comment on this, is one of the issues that they have in their list of demands. The Leon Ford has become a big issue for people because here's another young black male, in this case, fortunately not killed, but paralyzed possibly for life, from a traffic stop where he had his license, he had the ownership card, everything was appropriate, and yet what should have been a 3 or 4 minute stop, if at all, became a 16-minute stop, and one of the experts in the Leon Ford trial against the officers said that normally when a traffic stop extends itself, it usually leads to trouble. There were so many violations that the police committed in terms of procedures, including getting into his car. The paralyzation of Leon Ford is a permanent thing for him, and he needs no further adjudication from the district attorney or anybody else. And we're saying as we try to form a basis for improved community relations in Pittsburgh, and this administration, the mayor, the Peduto administration, has begun to do some positive things, the DA can assist that process by not retrying Leon Ford.
All right. Julia, this is one of the points that you want to make about Leon Ford. And, of course, Mr. Ford was found not guilty of aggravated assault. Jury was hung on some other counts, and he was found guilty of summary traffic charges by Judge Mack in careless driving, failing to yield at a stop sign, etc. This is one of the points that you want to make.
Yes, the demands that a collective group of activists, community organizers, and concerned citizens in Pittsburgh have put forth are, one, the indictment, arrest, and prosecution of Darren Wilson. That is something we will be addressing today at 2 o'clock at the federal building downtown to put pressure on the Department of Justice to bring charges against Darren Wilson and to prosecute him. The second is to drop all remaining charges against Leon Ford Jr. and assign desk duty for Officer Derbish. Right now, Officer Derbish, who shot Leon Ford Jr., is currently roaming the streets with a gun and a badge, and he can, have another instance where he is brutalizing another citizen.
He's not on administrative leave, nor has been assigned to desk duty. He is on his regular
Leon Ford Jr. has seen him several times. He is a victim of police brutality, and he has to look at the aggressor in the face on a day-to-day basis. That is absurd.
Okay. We have a caller on the line, and I'd like our guest to respond. Amir in Pittsburgh has a question about someone not having a weapon and why should a police officer be threatened. Amir, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. I have a question. The police officers today are armed almost like the military are armed in these different countries in Iraq and in other countries, and they have, like, stun guns. They have Glock 9s. They have shotgun rifles. They have all this equipment on them. And this guy has all this equipment on him. And this young man has nothing on him. Nothing. And then I heard your first guest say that the cop felt threatened. How do you feel threatened with all that equipment on you and this young man has nothing on him?
Well, let's get a response. And the first guest you were referring to is David Harris, who continues with us. That is the the testimony of the officer, not David Harris saying that, but that was his recount of the testimony of the officer. And David, if you would take that one step farther as well, and the law that allows police to escalate a step higher or a step farther.
Right. I certainly wasn't saying that it was reasonable for Officer Wilson to do that. What I was saying was, here's how it is legally tested. The person who used force, if it's a police officer, has to believe that it is reasonable to fear for great bodily injury or death before using deadly force. Now, that's the question the grand jury had to answer when it looked at the evidence. I don't take one side or the other on that. The officer doesn't have to be right. He has to be reasonable. And you can tell because of the open-ended nature of that legal standard how hard it would be to nail somebody down for not being reasonable, let alone correct. The question of the number of weapons, things like that, doesn't really get to the heart of it. The question is whether the officer would have reasonably felt in danger for his life. And I take no position on yes or no at this point. All I'm saying is that's the question that would have to be asked and answered.
All right. Julia, go ahead, Tim.
A quick comment. I need you to rephrase the question because I can't hear. But
the question had to do with the officer being well-armed and Michael Brown having being unarmed.
Yeah.
And why use the gun?
Why use the gun? There's a couple concerns that I have. I heard, I believe this morning – or in the middle of the night, that this officer is 6'4", 6 feet, 4 inches, and 210 pounds.
Right.
And he was making some comment that he felt like a kid beside this guy.
And now, Michael Brown was listed as about 6'4", anywhere from 250 up.
Yeah. So that doesn't quite seem logical. Now, if he were 5'9", and 150 pounds, maybe. So that just didn't sit with me well. The fact that there's variations, David, on this distance issue, that some shots may have been fired 100-plus feet away. How in danger can he be as a police officer with gun, handcuffs, baton, the whole thing? And Michael Brown, even though a relatively big young man, was not armed. If it was that bad, shoot him in both knees. Why do you have to shoot? And I didn't realize till this morning he shot at him 12 times.
Yes.
Maybe hitting him 6.
And according to Wilson's testimony, he shot him from 8 to 10 feet away.
So how much can he be in danger really?
Yeah, and that is.
I mean, really. I mean, how much can he be in danger, really, of his life, Darren Wilson's life? Mm-hmm. That's hard to wrap around.
Julia, you wanted to chime in.
Yes. The big issue with, number one, the verdict from the grand jury is that they took one witness's testimony as far as Mike Brown actually charging at the officer after he had been shot several times, turning around and charging at him. That is not what multiple other witnesses there that day saw. They saw Mike Brown turn around with his hands up. Others also say that he was well over 100 feet from the officer whenever he fatally shot him.
And this is what the prosecuting attorney said, conflicting information.
Right.
That's
so there's conflicting information and there's also
conflicting
racism.
Accounts, I should say.
Yes, there is also racism at play here because people have commented. I have heard from officers. I have heard from regular citizens in the U.S. that the very presence of Mike Brown, a young black man, was enough that his body was a weapon. Mm-hmm. People fear black men in the United States and black children, and they will shoot them dead because they fear from black people, just their very presence and their very being.
I call it the boogeyman effect. When I was executive director of the NACP, literally in the 70s, I was in my 20s, an FBI person came into our headquarters, and we had a little sit-down, just the two of us. You know what he said to me? Never forget. He said there were FBI studies that white people, when they report on a crime with a black person, their studies show the black person that they have in question or questioning is darker and bigger than they are in life. I call it the boogeyman effect. So, think about that. The whole psychology of race in America. Some people say we talk about race too much. People who say they don't see race. If you're in a room of all black people and somebody who's obviously white walks in, we all know a white person walked in. That doesn't mean we have to be angry at him or her. When all white people are sitting in and a black person walks in, that doesn't mean they have to be angry about it. But don't say you don't see race. And what we also have to admit is we all come to life with filters. Or through life, we establish filters of how we react to people. In the media, if you ask most people what is their image of a young black male, if you look at local news, it's a young black male in handcuffs. How often do you see a story of a black male with a positive story?
Right.
I mean, seriously, how often do you ever in local news see a black male talked about in a positive way? They're either coming out of the car in handcuffs or going into the police car with handcuffs.
Black people are stereotyped as thugs and criminals, and people view us that way, and that is why they are fearful, and their knee-jerk reaction is to kill us.
And that's the other reason why the relative absence of black people in the police force even becomes a bigger issue, because you have what I call the rewhitening of the police force once the consent decree, the Weber consent decree, that is, ended, David, in 1990. You had a rewhitening of the police force.
Right. This is where the police were ordered to hire. When they hired in force: one white male, one white female, one black male, one black female.
And you began to have some fair representation of blacks on the force. And at one point, I understand the percentage of women, and particularly in leadership, in the Pittsburgh Bureau was one of the top in the country. So when that Weber consent decree went away, so did that reality. That new reality became the old reality.
Okay, our guests are Tim Stevens. He is the chairman of BPEP, Black Political Empowerment Project. Also, we have Julia Johnson, a community activist who is one of the leaders of the demonstrations in the Pittsburgh area, a social justice activist, and David Harris, University of Pittsburgh law professor. If you have a call, a question for our guests, you can call 412-246-2002. Let's get back to the phones. And Jackson from Lawrenceville. Jackson, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes. Are you getting me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, my name is Jackson Omekai. My question is, I want to find out if the grand jury ever questioned the use of tasers, because I want to know the use of tasers before guns or guns before tasers in a situation like the one the police officer described.
Right. So why was the taser not used instead of the gun?
That bothers me, yeah. That's my question.
All right. Thank you very much, Jackson.
We know from
David
We know from the testimony, Jackson, that the officer was not carrying a taser at the time. But let's go to the broader part of your question: is why not use a taser in a situation like this if there was some kind of a threat? The rules with tasers are that they are non-lethal weapons. People sometimes die when they're tased, unfortunately, but they are non-lethal weapons, and therefore, if a police officer feels that there is a deadly threat, and I'm not taking a position on whether this one did or not, but if there is a deadly threat, police are not supposed to use tasers. They're supposed to go to deadly weapons. That is why if Officer Wilson felt he was in danger for his life, he would not actually be correct to use a taser. He would have to be right, he would have to use a firearm or another deadly weapon. So tasers are not substitutes for guns.
And the problem with that is, though, anyone could say, I fear for my life, so I'm going to go kill somebody. I mean, it's an open invitation.
But in this case, with Officer
and if your
Wilson,
head is messed up about every black person is a criminal, well, you could fear that. You could have that fear every moment of your life, and every black person you see, and you're an officer, and they're coming after you in any way, I must kill this person because they're going to kill me.
And the question.
So the whole premise creates the opportunity for death.
Okay. And the question is about why wasn't the officer have a taser? My understanding is there's only like one or a couple of tasers in the entire police force of Ferguson. So there we go. Let's go to another question from Bill in Freedom, Pennsylvania. Bill, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello. No disrespect towards the aspect of race here, but the situation is not just a racial situation. I'm a long hair with a beard. I travel around the country. I've been pulled over all around the country and harassed by police. Recently, Marion Barry just died, and I heard a little clip that I had never heard before where he states, the police are the problem. You don't have to be black. Asians, Mexicans, or Hispanics, all sorts of people, whites. Generally, if you're poor and you don't look quite right, and everyone faces abuse by the police. That's one of the problems, that when you're poor, you can't afford attorneys, and you're going to get screwed by the system.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. We'll have our guest respond to it. Julia.
Yes. So that is absolutely right, that police brutality affects everybody in the United States. Especially, though, it disproportionately affects black and brown and other people of color. So this is the heart of the issue here, is that not only is police brutality happening because there is a lack of accountability, but there is also systemic racism at play, where blacks are disproportionately targeted, harassed, arrested, and murdered by the police.
All right, let's go to another call. Getting lots of calls at 412-246-2002. Tony and Butler, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm here. The thing the young lady brought up about fear, I definitely believe that. And a white person being afraid of a black person, you know, I understand that. But I think society has changed to where even our children, you know, that you don't fear your parents. Your parents can't whip you. That would not be normal. That would be abuse. You know, you can't do this. And I feel, you know, I don't know why the young black man, whatever happened there. You know, if he thought he could be smart with the law officer or get away with something, there should be some sort of fear, you know, don't antagonize somebody or scare somebody because something bad is going to happen to you. If you scare a law officer or if a law officer is frightened of you, it's going to be a bad result.
All right, Tony, we're running a little short on time. Let me get our guest to respond. Tim.
Just a quick thing.
The idea about fear leads to violence, whether it's black-white perceptions, whether it is children, adults, it's just fear can lead to violence. And
it's called it's a bias that people carry about whatever group that they have issues with. And often the media support those negative images or whatever they may be. And part of what we began to do with the Black Political Empowerment Project recently and Alliance for Police Accountability, other groups, have these community meetings, community conversations right. with the new chief where he could respond to numerous questions that people wanted to know or suggestions, concerns, trying to build a new relationship because we had so much negativity in this town. But I think with what the mayor has done and his administration, we have some possibilities to move forward in a positive way. We want to reinforce that. But part of it is getting the communication in any group. To break down the boogeyman effect, as I call it, from any of these groups toward the other.
All right. Quickly, if you would, Julia, is there hope with the new police chief trying to reach out and with the Peduto administration? Do you have hope that maybe these incidents can be at least reduced?
Absolutely. Police Chief McClay has signaled that he definitely wants to have accountability top down in the police force. My issue is that local organizers and concerned members of the community need to step forward and put more pressure because right now they are not signaling enough changes in the police bureau. These are very superficial answers and solutions to the issue of systemic racism within the police force, and they have to be held accountable. And we can't have, you know, a case where it's drawn out, put into the media and politicized. And then even if we do get justice and a police officer is taken off the force, then through arbitration, the police union can go ahead and have somebody reinstated. This is absolutely ridiculous.
Julia Johnson is a local social justice activist and a lead organizer for today's rally. Tim Stevens is the chairman and CEO of the Black Political Empowerment Project. Folks, thanks so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
And coming up, as we continue our discussion, the role of the media and social media as Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.